That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of The Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to The Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. What's up, Lance?
Oh, what is going on? I mean, the sun's shining. It's a little chilly here, but I can feel spring around the corner. And with spring comes some good conspiracy theories.
It sure does. Dr. Lee Meller's new book, Conspiracies Uncovered, is now out. And you should pick it up. It's really good. It really kind of goes through them in chronological order. And it's interesting, Lance. And this conversation with Lee is great. It's compelling. We go through a lot of them. And he's so knowledgeable on the subject.
What I really like about it, and I think I mentioned it to him in the interview, is that there's so much history to it. And it's factual. He's not saying this exactly happened. He's giving you the elements that surrounded this particular incident and how that could relate to the next one down the line in more of a linear fashion, in a linear sense. We talked about Robert Kennedy's assassination. We talked about MK Ultra, the hippie culture, and how all of those might be connected in some way. He's super, super fascinating when he's talking about this. And they actually surprisingly left out a couple of chapters. He could have gone on and on with more of these conspiracy theories or conspiracies uncovered.
That's right. And he's releasing some content on his podcast, Murder Was the Case, which, of course, Lance, is on the Crawlspace Media Podcast Network. But he's releasing some of those chapters on his podcast. So if you read the book, it would really be a complete book if you were to listen to those chapters that were cut. So make sure to check out his podcast and follow Dr. Lee Meller on Twitter at Dr._Meller. There are links in the show notes.
Be sure to check out all of our fine shows at missingcsm.com or crawlspace-media.com.
Dr. Lee Meller, welcome back to the airwaves. How are you today?
Got a doctorate, got a new book, got a pirate hat. Feeling pretty cool, actually. How are you, Tim?
I am doing great.
I was wondering, you were holding up your book, and that, which is awesome, your book, Conspiracies, oh, you can't quite see here, Conspiracies Uncovered, your new book, and your other hand, you were, for those of you who aren't watching the video, you had your index finger up on your other hand. At the first glance, I thought you were giving us the finger, like, F you, I have a book, and then I'm like, no, that's his index finger, and then I thought you meant to, you were saying, like, it reached number one on, like, the New York Times bestseller list or something, but you were pointing to something even cooler. You were pointing to your doctorate, which is right above your shoulder there. That's amazing.
Yeah, and that's just a coincidence, by the way. This was a room that was free in the place where I'm staying right now. But when I set up my computer, I was like, oh, look at that in the background. Okay, so what did you call that, Lance? Humble brag?
I've never used the term humble brag.
He did.
It's a good one, though. I'll use it. I don't mind.
What are you doing? How are you? You were trapped overseas. Are you still trapped?
I'm trapped, but one could argue that I fell upwards. So that's a term I coined for when things fuck up for you and then it turns out to be for the best. So where I came from, Canada, there were no direct flights to Portugal. I'm looking for a house on the continent. You can get some beautiful rural properties out there, and I want to build like a giant studio and palace. You guys, of course, are invited to come stay, hang out. We'll have like video cameras, all kinds of stuff going on there. But there were no direct flights from Canada to Portugal because of the pandemic. So I said, okay, I'll go to England. I'll stop there for 10 days. I have my mandatory quarantine, and then I'll go from England to Portugal. And during that time, that new strain emerged and everything went into lockdown. And then I was just like, of course this would happen to me. Like, why would I ever catch a goddamn break? And then it turns out that Canada is something like 48th in the world now, as far as progress on the vaccines, and the UK is like number 3. So I'm looking at that through my optimism goggles going, well, I'm going to be vaccinated a lot more quickly being stuck here.
Well, that's a good thing. Unless, of course, you're an anti-vaxxer like, some conspiracy theorists who you may have written about in your new book, Conspiracies Uncovered.
I didn't actually get into the anti-vaxxing. I mean, the thing with the conspiracies is there's so many to pick from. I had to do some mixed mashes. Like, I have one on weather control, the HAARP facility in Alaska, and how it shoots beams into the ionosphere and causes sky quakes, and Hurricane Katrina was triggered by that and such. But then I use that also to sneak in chemtrails, because I couldn't have a chapter on each because there's only a finite amount of time in the book. So I didn't get around to anti-vaxxers. I mean, that's a whole book in itself.
For sure. Yeah, the anti-vaxxer thing, it's surprising you don't have it in here, but you're right. This book would be like triple the length. You cover so many conspiracies here. Before we get into some of your favorite ones, how did you even go through the process of narrowing them down to fit in a book that was so consumable in size?
Well, they give me the page count, the publisher, and then they said, you know, we have this list of conspiracies that you might want to work with, but we'll go back and forth and see which cases they have. And the publisher is based in the UK. And so they had some very quaint little British conspiracies. And I looked at them and I'm like, you know, these are charming. I get it. And if I was writing an encyclopedia of conspiracy theories, I would certainly include these. Gents, do not take offense, but when it comes to conspiracy theories, we're going full out American. Because if you want to go to like the absolute most batshit crazy for baby, like Patrick Swayze conspiracy theories, you have to start in the US of A. And they were very easily persuaded when I sent them the list back. A lot of them actually had no clue about some of the more modern ones in the book, like the death of Seth Rich. I think even a lot of Americans are not quite as acquainted with that one as they should be. A lot of the things surrounding Jeffrey Epstein. And yeah, so I kind of steered it in that direction. I was also looking for something that could be a thread that goes through everything, or at least a great deal of the book. And that is Nazi escapees at the end of the Second World War. So you have obviously Operation Paperclip, where Nazis are usually of some sort of intellectual or scientific importance, are brought over to the United States clandestinely and are used in the Cold War. So you have like Wernher von Braun, the famous rocketeer, you know, he's used in the space race. And the Soviets were doing the same thing. And I managed to meld that into a chapter about how the Catholic Church, and this is where it gets into, like, to what extent members of the Catholic Church certainly smuggled out hundreds of Nazi war criminals to South America. And they had this very Byzantine but obvious network in retrospect to do so. But you kind of start the buck with that conspiracy. One, did they get Hitler out? It's not as cut and dry as you might think. There's actually a chance, I think, that they did, unless I missed something huge. Still, I think probably less likely. But I tried to frame it in that way, where it's like, okay, so did Hitler get out? That's one chapter. How did he get out? Well, we know he got out through these complicit members of the Catholic Church, but did the Pope know? How was it the Catholic Church as an institution, or was it rogue members of the Catholic Church? That's kind of the conspiracy theory there. But then to end with, but oh, by the way, Operation Paperclip, a bunch of them got out to the United States too, including people that really should have hanged at Nuremberg. And that segues great into things like Area 51 and even last, you know, to some point into like the Kennedy assassination. And also there's Nazi remnants in the MKUltra mind control programs and everything. So what I tried to do is always have a thread from a previous conspiracy theory tying into subsequent chapters, because that in itself is sort of the spirit of conspiracy theories, right? Is forming connections. And sometimes they truly are there, and sometimes they're just like, well, it could be true.
Well, I feel attacked. I feel personally attacked about everything you just said.
As a flat earther.
Oh, yeah. I was merciless on them.
Which, rightfully so.
Okay, but let me put it like this. When it comes to, was the moon landing fake? There's a bit of research you have to do to debunk some of the claims. Like, why does the moon look so bright? Why does it look like a soundstage? I didn't know the answer to that, but it didn't take me a long time to find the answer to that. Other things like, do the ballistics make sense in the JFK assassination or the RFK assassination? Well, I'm not a ballistics expert. Like, there are people who specialize in doing this for a living, so I should really consult them. With the flat earth theory, I just sat in my backyard for 5 minutes and thought, and that's how I debunked it. Just simply thinking.
So to break down the title of your book, Conspiracies Uncovered, I often have a bit of an issue defining or coming up with the difference between uncovering a conspiracy and debunking a conspiracy. Because you can debunk, I guess, a conspiracy theory, but if you are uncovering a conspiracy, did you look into these circumstances and actually uncover a conspiracy? Like, let's say...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I guess my question is, what did you expect when you went into it? Were you going in completely open-minded and I'm going to uncover these conspiracy theories, or I'm going to debunk them? Because I think a lot of people, just when they hear conspiracy theory, they automatically go to, it's not real, it's made up, it's a conspiracy. But the word conspiracy exists. You know, there are conspiracies.
Oh, yeah, they're happening right now. They're going on all the time.
This interview is a conspiracy.
I don't even think it's happening.
If it is, I'm not in on it. Or am I a double agent?
What is the name on that doctorate?
Triple agent.
Yeah. So, like Ghislaine Maxwell's dad, but we won't get into that right now. So the question is, conspiracies uncovered. And so, like, did I personally uncover them? No, other people have uncovered them. And I went to those and I checked out, and like, yes, legit, the documents are there. The government has admitted to it, but still, for some reason, large remnants of the population do not realize that it happened, or don't seem to acknowledge the implications that something like that happens. So let's say one of the actual conspiracies that was uncovered, and is arguably one of the best chapters in the book, was the CIA mind control program, MKUltra. I mean, that that is so absolutely fascinating. But then once you have established that conspiracy and you know who is working with MKUltra, then it starts to move into the speculative, right? So you can have a conspiracy that's confirmed, but what that conspiracy managed to achieve and got their fingers into can then veer into conspiracy theory territory. A conspiracy theory or conspiracism, of course, is when you don't really have enough evidence to meet the standard of being able to say, yes, this is factually validated as a conspiracy. And, you know, some of them can be kind of tame. Like, I don't think that people who think there were two shooters at Dealey Plaza are completely off their rocker. And then you can juxtapose that with like the flat earth theory people, right? Or you can have the people who think there were two shooters at Dealey Plaza and that involved the mafia, the CIA, the aliens, yeah, like all that, the lizard people. So even the conspiracy theories, there's levels of believability and plausibility. Like I will definitely have time for someone that wants to sit down and give something that they can't prove, but they suspect, that is within reason. But some people just buy into everything. And that's one of the things I noticed, you guys know that I study sexual homicide and paraphilias, like fetishes. And one of the things I always say to cops when I'm training them, I said, the thing with paraphilias or, you know, fetishes is they're like cockroaches. You might see one, but there's actually probably like 10. For some reason, people with paraphilia tend to have more than one. And I noticed that about conspiracists. How your hardcore conspiracists, they don't just believe that the moon landing is fake. They also believe that JFK was killed and that Area 51 has aliens and that all three things are somehow linked with, you know, a big dollop of Epstein didn't kill himself in the middle, that kind of thing.
Right. Okay. So slow down here, Lee. This is getting out of control. We've talked about a lot of conspiracies already. Can you just tell us real quick about MKUltra? Because I do agree. I think that's one of the most fascinating chapters. And as you noted and wrote in the book, there's a lot of evidence backing this up, a lot of documents that were declassified backing this up. So, yeah, can you explain a little bit about what MKUltra is?
Right. So even before the Cold War began, the Nazis were looking into ways to control people's minds. So there are some roots in it there, but that's a very long story. I won't start at that point. When the Cold War began, communism was viewed by the American intelligence agencies as essentially like a type of mind control, a zombification. And that in order to combat this, you had to understand how it worked. And around this time also, during the 40s, LSD had been accidentally invented in Switzerland by this guy, Albert Hofmann. So you have this happy coincidence going on there. There are people pushing, hey, we really need to see if we can understand people's minds. And in the CIA, this is under, I guess it would have been, it starts off as the OSS, then becomes the CIA, would have been under Alan Dulles. And it goes from being Project Bluebird, which transforms into Project Artichoke, which then becomes MKUltra in, I think, about 1953. And where you really see this come to bear is during the Korean War, so early 50s. And you have these American pilots that are captured by Chinese or North Korean forces. And they go on the radio and they say, yeah, the Americans had us flying over the Korean Peninsula, spraying the whole thing with chemical agents. Now, the American government knew that that wasn't true. So they're saying, well, why are they going on the radio and saying this with such conviction? Why does it doesn't sound like they've got a gun to their head. You know, they seem like they believe it. And so when the war ended, they were trying to figure this out. They're like, there's been something that's been done to their minds. And actually the term brainwash entered the English lexicon at this point. It actually comes from wash brain. It's a Chinese word. So it's flipped the other way around, wash brain, brainwash in English. And so that emerged from the Korean War. They hired a psychiatrist called Louis Jolyon West to help deprogram these pilots. And he was successful in doing that. So what had happened is there was some mind control going on the communist side, where they had captured these American pilots, and whatever they did to them, I'm not quite sure, but they had convinced them that, yes, we had sprayed stuff across the Korean Peninsula. And so at this point, they start to take the mind control thing very seriously. And they appoint this strange man, Sidney Gottlieb, who is this Jewish guy from New York. I think he's from humble origins. He's got a club foot. He has a lot stacked against him, but he's a chemist and he's got a brilliant mind. And they're looking at the program at this point and they're saying, it's kind of stuck. It's not advancing. Maybe we need to bring in someone fresh. And this Gottlieb guy seems like the man for the job. So they bring him in and they start to then come up with a series of projects. You wouldn't believe how far this spans. One of the things that happens is they start Operation Midnight Climax, and I want to make an erotica film about this once COVID is done.
Too late. I've already copywritten that.
Well, we can make it together.
Ah. Continue.
So, if my mind is recalling, and I think it's actually conjuring up the correct name, they get this other guy on board MK Ultra called George Hunter White. And they set up in San Francisco this apartment. And it's got a one-way mirror that, okay, so there's two apartments. A one-way mirror looks from one apartment into the other. And George Hunter White sits in the empty apartment, and he gazes through and he observes through the one-way mirror. And then what they do is they pay sex workers to bring their clients back to this other place and give them LSD. And then George Hunter White sits there with like a pitcher of martinis, just drinking it and watching them fuck on acid. I guess there was more to it than that. One of the things that they realized is that when you combine LSD and sex, it really loosens men's tongues. So they're thinking to themselves, like, this is better than torture. Like, it turns out that if you just give people acid and get them the fuck, that you get more information out of them than having to torture them. So these were the conclusions that they were drawing at the time. The fun thing is, like, do you honestly believe that they didn't get in on this? Because I should explain that these are parts of the CIA that are unknown to the CIA. So you have the CIA that knows about aspects of the CIA, and then you have other little cells of the CIA which are more or less hidden from the organization itself. Or they're so independent and sort of like, we don't need to know what you're doing, that these guys are like, we got all this money, we've got all this LSD. Like, are we really not going to get in on this fun too? We're just going to sit there watching them.
And wasn't it historically like no oversight to that particular program? Like you said, they got all this money and no one was really checking in on them. So it's kind of hard to believe that they wouldn't get involved in that party like orgy atmosphere. Why in the world would a government agency provide strong drugs and a ton of money and expect anything not weird to happen? Like, they had to expect something weird to happen.
Well, at that time, they had no idea about LSD, really. No one had taken it. And I mean, this is where it goes next. Maybe what I should do is move on to how this backfires.
Whoa, this backfired?
Oh, this backfires big time. Because remember, this whole idea is to fight communist brainwashing. It's to push back against, let's say, rampant leftism, as they would conceive of it. So Gottlieb, who is an interesting character, he decides, he's like, let me try. Give me some of the acid. I want to see what it's like. I need to know. And he takes it. And then he becomes convinced this is the key to it all. This is the key to mind control as LSD. So then they set up a series of experiments, which are run at universities by people who are interested in the effects of different substances on people's brains, namely in this case, LSD. Now, I should at this point put this in. It's not like the CIA writes a check and just sends it to some academics at a university. There's always this mediator that has some kind of inconspicuous name. I'm just making this up, but like the Center for Psychological Understanding Advancement or something like that, or an institute for it. And they're really just a CIA front. And so that's how the money gets from the CIA through this innocuous little organization and into the hands of these researchers. So these guys start doing kind of what they do today with students, except involving LSD. I mean, I guess they're still doing it somewhat because they were doing cocaine studies when I was in school, but where they would pay students or give them credit of some kind to come on into the lab, take this substance, and either do these set of tasks or just let us observe you, whatever. And one of the places that they were doing this was in California, near San Francisco, near Berkeley, all the schools around there. Is Stanford there?
Yeah, yes. It's up there.
Okay, I think it was Stanford. So you have the burgeoning, brilliant author, Ken Casey, who is studying there. And Ken Casey decides that he's going to go in and, I don't know, make some free money, get some extra credit. Maybe he's just genuinely curious and he's going to try this LSD stuff. Well, so you give it to this exceptional creative mind and he's like, oh man, this is going to change the world. So then they get Allen Ginsberg, the famous beat poet who, you know, wrote Howl, and he comes in and he tries it and he agrees. And so what happens is Ken Casey and some of his confederates are able to get a hold of all of this acid and they start throwing these giant, like everyone take LSD parties, you know, Hell's Angels are coming to them, all these students. And then they decide, what we've got to do is we can collectively alter the consciousness of America. So they buy this bus. This is all documented in the electric Kool-Aid acid test. And they call themselves the Merry Pranksters. And the bus is driven by Neil Cassidy from Jack Kerouac's On the Road. And there, I think there's members of the Grateful Dead that keep coming and going. But you've got to understand, this was before the whole hippie thing. This preceded it. And so what they do is they drive all over the United States. I think they go down south and then east, you know, and then up and into New York City. And the whole time they're just giving people acid in the form of Kool-Aid. And the tie-dye shirt is actually invented by accident. I think it was in a puddle in Arizona. Someone decided to, hey, let's throw some paint in here and just put this shirt in, and it came out. So what ultimately happens is in their efforts to combat communism or the spread of radical leftism through understanding how to control and manipulate people's minds, they actually turn people on to acid. And Ken Casey and the Merry Pranksters return to San Francisco and kind of are the driving originators that give birth to hippies and the counterculture. And then the CIA has to go into damage control, and that part gets fun too. But I've been talking a bit, so we can pause there for a moment for you gents to comment or ask questions.
No, it's a really fascinating transition of cultures in American history, at least, because you had this image of America being the Leave It to Beaver 50s family unit, and over the course of just a few years, it becomes this Grateful Dead, long hair, you know, the hippie culture, the counterculture. And it's a fun factoid to note that I think Ted Kaczynski and Whitey Bulger both volunteered for this CIA-backed experiment. Some would say that that wasn't a backfire at all. I mean, imagine where we'd be without that experiment.
Oh, we'll go there. We'll go into uncharted territory here. So let's play a bit. Having now established MKUltra and how it gives birth to the counterculture movement, before I move on to the most extreme conspiracy theory, which I actually think has more credence than people want to believe, I do think this is worth mentioning. So recall I brought up the psychiatrist Louis Jolyon West. He's known as Jolly West. And he is the guy who deprogrammed all of the pilots or the military men who were kidnapped during the Korean War. And so he's MKUltra. This isn't, by the way, none of this part of it is a guess or a rumor. It's confirmed. They were employees. It's in the documents. This all came out when the CIA director at the time, Richard Helms, was approached by Nixon, President Nixon, during Watergate. And Nixon said to him, "Hey, man, you got to help me out here. I'm in a lot of trouble." And Richard Helms is like, "No, you're on your own. Like, you're screwed." And Nixon goes, "Okay, well, you don't get any protection from me." And then Richard Helms goes, "Oh, shit, all the bad stuff we've been up to," and just starts destroying all these documents. Fortunately, he didn't get to destroy all of them. And there were two separate, I guess you would call them hearings, inquiries that looked into this. And both found that, yes, MKUltra does exist. Here were the employees. So none of this is conjecture. This is a genuine conspiracy, no theory part. Now we're going to start foraying into the parts which are suspicious, but let's just say unsubstantiated. So 1964. President Kennedy has been shot in November of the previous year by Lee Harvey Oswald, who was shot 2 days later by Jack Ruby. So Jack Ruby stands trial and is found guilty. And when Ruby finds out that he's guilty, he gets infuriated with his attorneys and he says, I want different attorneys for my appeals process. I want to appeal this. And there was a guy who was both a lawyer and a mental health professional in the court that his team had used that particularly impressed Jack Ruby. So Ruby's like, "I want that guy for my appeals." So this guy comes on and he becomes Jack Ruby's appeals lawyer. And this fellow says to Jack Ruby, he says, "Well, you know, I think it would really help if we assessed your mental health." And Ruby, "Okay, you know, you're my attorney, whatever you think is best." And so who lands at Dallas Love Field to perform the mental health assessment on Jack Ruby? A innocuous little doctor named Jolly West. And he walks into Jack Ruby's cell to talk to him, to perform the mental health evaluation. There's no one else in there. He exits the cell and he announces to the world, "Ladies and gentlemen, it seems that sometime within the past 72 hours that Mr. Ruby has suffered a complete psychotic break. I can't really do anything for him. He's lost his mind." Now, note this. Before that, no mental health professional had ever noted any kind of psychosis in Jack Ruby. And after that, nobody ever didn't notice it. So, man, are you telling me that it's just a coincidence that an MKUltra psychiatrist walked into Jack Ruby's cell when he'd never been noted as being psychotic before, and then he left, and suddenly Jack Ruby was forever more psychotic. I guess it's just a coincidence, man. That's the conspiracy theory part.
Sounds like a conspiracy fact to me.
I mean, it's a pretty unstable thing to do to shoot someone, you know, which is what Ruby did.
Yep.
Rex Sherman is a demon that walks among us, a predator that ruined families.
The LISK, Long Island Serial Killer Podcast, was shocked when the news broke of Rex Huerman's arrest. After more than a decade of searching, law enforcement officials had finally pieced together enough evidence to bring formal charges against Rex Huerman. Initially charged with 3 murders, Huerman is now officially charged with all 4 deaths in the Gilgo 4 case. I'm your host, Chris Moss, and the LISK podcast will be releasing new episodes with interviews and fresh insight on the case as Rex Huerman awaits trial in Long Island. While we are relieved by the arrest, the LISK podcast team will be working hard to share new developments and perspectives as we get them. So please keep your eyes and ears out for new episodes, and if you haven't already, please listen to seasons 1 and 2 of LISK, Long Island Serial Killer, wherever you listen to podcasts.
How's it going, everyone? It's Tim and Lance here. Have you ever wanted someone to read you creepy bedtime stories in the most velvety voice ever?
Well, you had me hooked at velvety, Tim. We are excited to share a podcast that is exactly that. It's called Nighty Night Bedtime Stories to Keep You Awake. And Tim, it's narrated by a friend of ours.
That's right. New York Times bestselling author and podcaster Rabia Chaudhry. Nighty Night is an anthology featuring classic horror stories this season and fictionalized true life stories in season 1 that are so creepy that you will realize reality is scarier than fiction.
And Tim, I know our favorite part of each episode is at the end when Rabia says, "But wait, there's more to the story." And we get to hear those fascinating details about the author and the context of the tale. What's your favorite episode?
My favorite episode is The Tiny Hairs from season 1, which takes us on a harrowing journey when the narrator runs into a dangerous man in the woods. What about you?
Well, mine comes from the current season. It's called The Horla, in which we witness the protagonist spiral into a descent of madness. Tim, I feel like I'm constantly spiraling into a descent of madness, so I really relate to that one.
Well, I hear that. So dim your lights, get under a cozy blanket, and find and subscribe to Nighty Night wherever you get your podcasts.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Nighty Night, everyone.
In a small town in Colorado, people turn to a family-run funeral home in their deepest moments of loss. Run by a mother and daughter team, the funeral home offered thoughtful services at a fair price. But there was a dark side to their business.
It was truly a house of horrors.
He said she may have dismembered him and sold parts of him.
I'm getting angry all over, a small sweat breaking out.
I'm investigative reporter Ashley Fonts, and this is the story of an unbelievable crime you've never heard of. A story of a funeral home that lured their victims in the front door only to sell their bodies out the back. From Campside Media and Sony Music Entertainment, listen to Cover Up, Body Brokers. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
I thought you were going to RFK's death as a Manchurian candidate because that one seemed, yeah, that one seemed really like I this Jack Ruby one. I could buy it.
I 100% buy it.
Yeah, but the RFK one I thought was particularly compelling.
Let's try and get there chronologically. Okay.
Let's do it. You won't.
Okay. So we've established this character now. He's a suspicious, documented, absolutely 100%. We know that this guy was an MK Ultra employee, Jolly West. So 1964, he walks into Jack Ruby's cell, walks out. Suddenly Ruby's a psychotic. Now you have, because of the CIA backfire, you've got the hippie movement kicking off in San Francisco. Everyone's having a good time. And who shows up just before the summer of love around Haight-Ashbury and opens up another Operation Midnight Climax type project.
Alan Alda.
Well, there are rumors that he was involved. It could have been a twin, a robot clone, shape-shifting lizards, but it was what they say, okay, it was Dr. Jolly West. And so he shows up there, and right in the middle of the counterculture, right at Haight-Ashbury, and he's got a whole other iteration of Midnight Climax going on. Also, now here's where it gets wild. He has an office at the newly established Haight-Ashbury Free Medical Clinic. And on the surface, this is just a really good charitable institution because you have all these hippies that are doing drugs, that are, you know, having free love and contracting venereal diseases and having bad trips and stuff. And so this noble institution opens up in that area to offer them free medical services. And Jolly West has an office in it. And the guy who establishes it is I think he was either a psychologist or a psychiatrist called David Smith. And he's getting funding from the CIA through one of these mediators too. Tom O'Neill, a journalist who wrote a book recently called Chaos, seems to have established this. And David Smith's interests are in the effects of drugs on people in terms of how does it affect them? How does it make them violent? Another guy working there is a criminologist called Roger Smith. So three guys who have offices. Roger Smith, at the Haight-Ashbury Free Medical Clinic. Roger Smith is also receiving funding for his interesting research on the effects of drugs on people and how it may lead to violence. So three guys, all connected to the CIA, all right in the middle of the counterculture at this free medical clinic. And get this, Roger Smith, the criminologist, is Charles Manson's parole officer.
Could be a coincidence.
Could be. Let's go a little further. Charlie Manson gets out of prison and he's in Los Angeles. He's not allowed. This is, of course, before all the murders. Charlie was in and out of prison his whole life. He gets out in Los Angeles. One of his parole conditions is you can't leave this area. Well, within 2 days, Charlie's headed up to San Francisco. Now, this is a repeat offender. He's immediately violated the terms. He should be back in prison almost immediately, but he doesn't. He gets to San Francisco, and all of a sudden, he's got this new parole officer, Roger Smith, and Roger Smith just, makes a phone call or something, and it all just goes away. And this becomes a pattern because Charlie, and this is not documented in Vince Bugliosi's book, which is really strange, but Charlie, of course, was hanging around Haight-Ashbury at the time, and he was building the family. And the family and Charlie are always getting into trouble with the law. They are always stealing things. The family are like the women in the family actually are getting underage boys to get into orgies with them and giving them acid. Does this sound familiar? No pun intended on the familiar. It's a family affair, right? But the thing is, they get caught for this. They get in trouble and they're brought in. And Susan Atkins is one of the most prominent and homicidal Manson family members. She's already in trouble, like Charlie. She's already got conditions, and they on several occasions are locked up and facing criminal charges. And it's like, just call Roger Smith. And Roger Smith doesn't just get Charlie out of these situations. He gets members of the families out of these situations. At one point, when Charlie is temporarily arrested, Roger Smith is looking after Charlie's kid. Charlie becomes Roger Smith's only client, I guess you would call it. So Roger Smith is the parole officer only of Charles Manson. I will reiterate, Roger Smith is receiving funding for his experiments on drugs and violence through a CIA mediator. Now, I could keep going, but take this to its logical conclusion. What are the Manson murders? The Manson murders are seemingly senseless, ultra-violent murders committed against strangers by members of the Manson family who are out of their mind on drugs. And so someone asked Tom O'Neill, the guy who researched this, they said, well, was this an MK Ultra experiment gone wrong? Or sorry, O'Neill asked an expert on this. He said, was this, okay, an MK Ultra experiment that just went wrong somehow? And this MK Ultra expert replied to Tom O'Neill and said, no, this was an MK Ultra experiment gone right. And we know that, or we can strongly suspect it, because if you go back and you look at some of those documents that were salvaged, some of the aims of the things that they wanted to achieve in the MK Ultra program was, I wonder if it's possible if we can get people to mindlessly kill. That's me paraphrasing. But that's a hell of a lot of coincidences, wouldn't you agree, guys?
Well, also you said that they senselessly killed strangers. Those strangers, I mean, famous people. So that was going to make the news. Like Sharon Tate was famous and Polanski, her husband, was famous. And I don't know if it would have had the same effect. It would have had an effect, of course, if it was just your average school teacher and her husband or something. But the fact that they targeted famous people, I don't know, leads me to believe that they wanted the statement to be made.
Right, which plays into something which I didn't emphasize enough in the book for spatial reasons. But the CIA was running a program at the time called Project Chaos, all capitals C-H-A-O-S. And the FBI also had a program, COINTEL, which was similar, but it was damage control for the counterculture movement that they'd unleashed. So the whole point of Chaos was to make hippies the whole peace and love. Hey, you know, they're gentle people that just want to put an end to the war and they use drugs, but it's just to expand their minds. And they needed to counter that perception that the public had. And what way to do it better than to have a bunch of drugged out hippies murder celebrities, as you pointed out, which is going to make the news, and then write race war type slogans on the walls. I mean, it makes a bit more sense than the Bugliosi version, doesn't it?
It actually does kind of make some weird kind of sense, you know.
And you're referencing Helter Skelter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's disturbing to think that the government could have been up to such, or really was up to such, kind of trifling experiments. But I don't necessarily think there's government people twirling their mustache. It's more like this thing got out of hand. Is that an appropriate read, you think?
Well, I think at this point we're in conspiracy theory land. So MK Ultra is a bona fide conspiracy. Mm-hmm. But when we get into how much, if at all, Charles Manson and the family were involved in the MK Ultra program, then we just get speculative. So that's where I become sensible, I think. And this is what made me the right guy to write the book. I'm open-minded. I'm artistic. I will entertain ideas. I don't shut things down just as a fashion. I am inquisitive, but I'm also logical, and I usually know when to stop. And so that's where I stop. And it's okay to say, I don't know, but I've given you the facts. You take them and go with them. You know, run with them wherever you want, or just go, nah, sounds too convoluted.
Yeah, I like how you do that in the book too. You don't really, you know, push anything. You kind of, as you say, you let people make up their own minds. And I definitely, again, I'm going to go back to that RFK one as being one of the most suspicious and most compelling chapters in the book. I had not known a lot of those things. The JFK one struck me as Oswald was very mentally ill, and this isn't so much a conspiracy. But the RFK one is a completely different read to me.
Really cool to hear someone approach RFK the way you did, because RFK always gets overshadowed by the JFK conspiracies, and RFK is, like Tim said, like there's a lot of stuff in there that a lot of people just don't know because he's not as, he wasn't a president yet, and it's not as covered in such great detail. What made you like gravitate to that? Was that part of the timeline as well?
Yeah, well, these things all flow naturally into one another chronologically. So, I mean, if you go from JFK, you can get to MKUltra through the Jack Ruby connection with Jolly West, right? And so then you get into the MKUltra program, and you can get from MKUltra into RFK. So it just made sense to sort of, you know, you have appetizers, dinner, and dessert. They all complement each other. So I tried to write the book in that way, and the 60s lent itself to that very well. So yeah, the whole Manchurian candidate theory with Sirhan, I mean, this is a complex one. What I think the reason is that it doesn't get as much play as the JFK assassination is because Sirhan did shoot RFK. That is absolutely undeniable. This wasn't some sniper shot taken from a long distance. He went right up to him and pulled out a gun and fired. But there are suspicious elements about it. The reason I initially wanted to put it in, I thought it was really important, was because RFK was never supposed to leave via that route. He was supposed to go downstairs and address people in this other room, but sort of at the last minute, it was like, no, actually, you know, Senator Kennedy, we're going this way. Well, this way just happens to be where, for some reason, a Palestinian American is waiting for him with a gun. It's, once again, it's an odd coincidence. And so it's often described as a kitchen, but it's more like a kind of pantry area that they lead him off stage to. And one of the more, let's say, skeptical explanations is that there was just so much going on at that time that he got separated from his security and some of the other people. But as he's going through this pantry and, you know, saying hello to everyone, Sirhan, who's in there seemingly waiting for him, but doesn't know that he's coming through to our knowledge. I mean, that's the odd part. Why would Sirhan think that he's coming through there? How would he know that? You got this giant hotel. So that in itself always struck me as bizarre. And then he sort of leans forward and he fires at RFK, and RFK is killed. But when they ask Sirhan about it later, he gives this really interesting story. They say, okay, well, you know, why did you do it? He gives kind of contradictory stories at different points in time, but let's stick to the kind of mystery part of it right now. He says that he doesn't really recall a great period of time between going to this hotel just to have, I think he was going to this hotel just to have a few drinks or something like that, and just kind of hang out. And he realized that he'd had a little bit too much to drink and that he needed to kind of sober up a bit before he drove home. And then he encountered this woman with a polka dot dress who becomes this mysterious figure that permeates the whole RFK case. And upon meeting this woman with the polka dot dress, this is sort of where his mind blanks. And he's described by a lot of people who witness him as being like kind of robotic, you know, when he kills RFK. And he claims that he only came to his senses once, someone had grabbed his arm and slammed it into a nearby table or countertop or something like that. Once he was being wrestled after the assassination had occurred, it was like all of a sudden he came back to reality. So if you want to go with the MK Ultra mind control Manchurian candidate angle, you would say, well, it seems that this woman in the polka dot dress may have been an MK Ultra agent, and who knows what they'd done. Maybe they implanted something in his mind beforehand that made him go to the hotel. And once he was there, they sent an agent to sort of like flick the switch. And then the fugue state came on, and he only awoke after Kennedy was killed. I mean, that would be the conspiracist explanation of it. There's also strange ballistic evidence in the case. There's bullets which seem to do U-turns and come from behind. There's a door which has bullet holes in it that would mean that more shots were fired than Sirhan's handgun had the capacity to fire, because they could account for a lot of these bullets and holes. But when this door was photographed, and you can pull that up on the internet, and the LAPD just kind of took it. And if I recall, it just kind of conveniently went missing and nothing much was done about it. So there's quite a lot of smoke there. And so another aspect I should mention is that one of RFK's security guards that night was actually a Kennedy family hater, an outspoken one. And he was hired from a private security firm. And you can see him right beside RFK in the, you know, one of the canonical photographs of RFK being assassinated. And some of the injuries, like, so Sirhan shoots RFK. RFK kind of turns, and so I'm trying to mix in the skeptical and the conspiracist versions of this. So RFK turns, that's important. But when they look at the wounds in RFK, a lot of them seem to have come from behind and angled up through his back. And I think one was lodged in his neck, one of the bullets. So the shot seemed to have come from behind, and that's where that anti-Kennedy private security bodyguard would have been. And during the chaos, one could argue that he could have pulled out this gun. Everyone's got their eyes on Sirhan, who is firing, but the kill shots actually come from this other fellow. Now, I can give you the whole skeptics debunking of at least some of these things. I think it is definitely worth pointing out that RFK had, I believe, in a speech in Oregon sometime before this, pledged to send more fighter jets to Israel. And of course, Sirhan being a Palestinian, and he saw himself as one of the marginalized peoples of America that RFK, spoke out to help. So you had like Cesar Chavez and the sort of migrant labor movement there. You had disenfranchised African Americans. And so RFK was a guy who was speaking out for the underdog. Sirhan saw himself like that. And then when RFK gave that speech, Sirhan's like, wait a minute, I thought you wanted to help downtrodden people. You want to send these planes to Israel. I know what they're going to be used for, because I was there. My brother was crushed by a tank. And so he at various times has given this as his motive for killing RFK too, which, like, if that's it, then I mean, that's fairly clear. But
right,
why all these other weird elements?
Kind of hard for me to wrap my head around somebody getting so angry and I know he used like alcohol as one of the controlling factors or the triggering factors in his decision to kill Bobby Kennedy, but and also it was a different time back then, right? I mean, people were very patriotic, whether they were patriotic for this country or the country, you know, they came from. And if you came from a country where such atrocities happened directly to your family, you know, I can't speak to that. Maybe I would do something like that. Maybe I'd have some drinks, know that this guy was at the Ambassador Hotel and say, you know, maybe I'll just give him a piece of my mind and then have some sort of break. Maybe.
It's a lot of elements in play for, you right? know, if it's a conspiracy, I will say, you know, it sounds compelling. And I remember the ballistics evidence you use in the book really made me wonder. But yeah, I mean, it could have all come together, but man, that's a lot of moving pieces.
That's the issue. So let's clear some things away that we can easily, you know, dismiss here. So the whole girl in the polka dot dress theory. So there was, I can't remember her exact role, apologies, but there was a Latina woman who was sitting outside on the fire escape. I believe it was at the time that RFK was killed. And she claims that a woman in a polka dot dress and two other guys, it might have been one, doesn't really matter, but a woman in a polka dot dress ran down and they said, "We did it, we did it." And she said, "What?" She's like, "We killed Kennedy." And so the polka dot dress girl sightings confirmed by that person and then by another male witness. So conspiracy theorists have taken that and they've said, well, look, there's eyewitnesses. Sirhan himself said that this happened. So like what, this woman in the polka dot dress thing isn't real? Well, it turns out there was some cross-contamination where these two witnesses would have talked before going in to speak with the police. And it's probable that the woman told the man about this and maybe created a false memory. It's really interesting how people's memories work. But for instance, the fire department went and they looked at the fire escape where she claimed to have been sitting on at that time, and they were able to forensically refute that she had ever been there. So I'm not going to speculate on what her motives were, but, you know, a fact's a fact. And this is the issue with conspiracy theorists is sometimes they want to believe in it so bad. They're like, well, the fire department was in on it, man. You know, the LAPD was in on it, man. It's, you know, and sort of one of the, I would say, the cardinal rules of conspiracy theories is the more individuals and agencies in different parts of the world or country that are involved in it, the less realistic it's likely to be. So with like flat earth theory, I told you I sat outside for 5 minutes and thought of a way of refuting it. I realized you would have needed something like hundreds of millions of people, if not more, to be complicit in this conspiracy theory. And that in itself, beyond just the physical elements and the other stupidity around it, makes it fall apart. So I'm inclined to believe that it's more likely that somebody either lied, exaggerated, or thought that they perceived something and did so incorrectly than that, you know, the LAPD, the fire department, and all these other elements, the CIA, they were all in on it. I just don't think that. So girl in the polka dot dress, it's also been pointed out that polka dot dresses in the 60s, like they were in fashion. So there would have been lots of girls in polka dot dresses around. So if other people at the hotel had seen that, yeah, you might've seen a girl in a polka dot dress. It doesn't mean it went down the way that it did. And when Kennedy was shot in the kitchen, a whole bunch of people come racing out of the kitchen yelling all kinds of things. Now, in that chaos, do you know exactly what it is that you would have heard? You might hear them say something that they didn't actually say, or maybe they said it like, "We killed Kennedy." Okay. And you could think, oh, those particular people killed Kennedy, but maybe they're talking about the greater we, like, you know, the American people. We did it again. We killed Kennedy. Like, what's wrong with us? Something like that, right?
It's possible. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely possible that part didn't happen too, you know, or as you said, wasn't ever really uttered that way outside. That I could believe.
But it is still strange. Like, what we've got to always keep in mind is that Sirhan was there with a gun. So his whole story about, oh, I just kind of went there to check it out and have a few drinks. It's like, then why did you bring a loaded gun?
Well, it was the 60s.
How did you end
America,
up
in America, man?
How did you end up in the probably one of the least probable areas that RFK would have gone through, right? This sort of kitchen pantry area. How is it that you ended up standing in there? Did you just get so lucky you made what on paper seems to be the dumbest decision to assassinate him? And then he was sort of led right into your path. And the ballistics is suspicious too. So like with the Manson connection, I actually lean more towards believing. I can't prove it, but I find that one pretty convincing. With the Manchurian candidate, Sirhan RFK thing, I lean a little bit more towards disbelieving, but I'm not taking either of them completely off the table because there's too many strange occurrences to account for.
I got to say, the book is fascinating and historical too, which is really cool. Like you learn a bit about history as well as stimulate your, you know, that part of your brain where you like to hear about conspiracies and exercise those thoughts. So tip of the old cap to you there. I was going to say cowboy hat, but you've got the market on the cowboy
hat. I can't wear the cowboy hat with the headphones. I've tried.
You got to get a cowboy hat with headphones in it, like attached.
That's right.
Yeah, that sounds real cool.
That's super cool.
Yeah. Yes.
Maybe I could get some phone guns too.
Pew, pew. Well, Lee Meller, you've done it. You've come on here and you've told us about your book, Conspiracies Uncovered. It's a great book. Go pick it up. Conspiracies Uncovered, Cover-Ups, Hoaxes, and Secret Societies by Dr. Lee Meller. Thank you very much. And check out Murder Was the Case, your fantastic podcast on the Crawlspace Media Network.
I should also point out that some chapters were cut at the end of the production line by someone higher up at DK. Maybe that's a conspiracy man, or maybe they just felt it was a prudent decision. I don't know. But one of the ones they cut was on Pizzagate, which bridged my Seth Rich assassination and Epstein chapters rather nicely. Fortunately, my publisher, DK Books, was generous enough to give me the chapter back to use as I saw fit. So what I did is the last episode of my podcast, I just read out the Pizzagate chapter. So if you buy the book, what I would do is I would read up to Seth Rich, then I would listen to the episode, and then I would continue on from Epstein. And it even goes all the way up to COVID-19, by the way, and the conspiracies, conspiracy theories around that of various types.
The other conspiracy fact, which I'll say, is the one that Tim is actually a Kennedy. They left that one out. They told you to take that one out because of his hair. So, I mean, it was such a short chapter anyway. You said Tim Paliri is a Kennedy, and then you showed a picture of his hair, and it's clear that he's a Kennedy. I was surprised that they had you take that one out.